welcome to the Fourth Roots podcast. It's also the first of 2018, so happy new year to all our listeners.
It's our first podcast for a while because we've been busy with three major Roots events we have coming up in the next few months.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got Roots Americas in Quito, Roots Asia in Brisbane, and then over to Roots Europe in Bilbao. Our Americas event is taking place in February in Quito, and among the speakers is Juan Carlos Suazua, CEO of Mexican LCC Viva Aerobus.
Juan Carlos is delivering a keynote address at the event, but he also spoke at World Roots 2017 in Barcelona. He took part in an airline CEO panel discussing disruption in the industry, including Brexit, Trump, technology, and a wide range of other topics.
He was joined on the panel by fellow airline bosses Tuolda Gebremariam of Ethiopian Airlines, Giorgio Cagliari of Aeroflot, and WOW Air's Scully Mogensen.
Moderator for the panel was John Biley, who is the father of Open Skies in the US and who played an instrumental role in opening new trade links between the country and markets across the world.
So let's head straight off to John and his introduction to the session and the panellists taking part.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much. To get started, let me offer just a few introductory thoughts about the dimensions of disruption, Darwinian evolution in the aviation world. Whatever the term you use for change, disruption, evolution, it's clear that airlines confront really big challenges today. And I'll mention four kinds, and then we'll turn to the panel and have a discussion of them. First, new business models in the airline industry, including the expansion of low-cost carriers into longer-haul markets. And Schooley's certainly one who can talk to that with a lot of experience and, frankly, a lot of success. I think Juan Carlos can also talk to a very unique low-cost model, a little less long-haul, but certainly expanding, and started as a bus company, if I remember. A second source of disruption is new technology. That technology can be new aircraft types. We've seen disruption from the 787, from the beginning to see it with the 737 MAX, the Airbus A350, the A320neos coming online, Bombardier's new C-Series aircraft, and there's some other potentials on the horizon. Likewise, there was a mention of Google. Are they going to own the world? New travel distribution technology is really affecting the way airlines operate today, increasing the role of technology leaders in our business sector. Who will own customers in the future? Will it be airlines? The way I'd say they sort of own their customers today. Or will it be Google? And the airlines will just be suppliers. They'll provide a brand, they'll provide a product, and Google will brand it and sell it and will own the customer because of the knowledge base they have. A third category of disruption, it's a troubling one. I'll call it external disruption. Terrorism, war, natural disasters. We've certainly had in my home country enough of those with horrible hurricanes in Texas and Florida. I spoke to a colleague from Orlando. She's okay. Her brother's house had a tree fall through the middle of it. Tremendous effect on airlines, on tourism, on airports. Unpredictable political swings. I'd also add to the category of external disruption. It can be Brexit. It can also be anti-immigration policies in the United States. How do you, panel of CEOs, plan for such contingencies? How do you build an airline that can bounce back from crisis, adjust to new realities? The fourth and final category of disruption I'd mention is new thinking. Who just 25 years ago would have imagined that today so many countries would have emulated this crazy idea of open skies, sort of invented in the United States, but it spread to so many other areas? Or who would have thought just 20 years ago that the European aviation scene would have been so fundamentally remade by the creation of the common aviation area in Europe and the extraordinary rise of low-cost carriers like Ryanair, EasyJet, Norwegian? Wow. I hope our panelists will identify the sorts of new thinking that they'd like to see happen, or maybe some elements they wouldn't like to see happen. For example, will ownership and control rules be loosened, a hearty perennial topic at all aviation conferences, a little bored of that sometimes? Will it be abandoned, or will it just stay the way it's been forever? We're seeing changes even if the rules stay the same, the realities are changing. Or might there be a major disruption with not new thinking, but a resurgence of old thinking, protectionism, nationalism growing? We've certainly got those themes. They're present in Europe, they're present in the United States, they're present elsewhere. Giorgio, I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
So Aeroflot, talk about change.
Yep.
It's transformed itself from, I guess I'd say, the flag carrier of the Soviet Union with a reputation for not exactly the best customer service in the world. You are an improbable success story. Your airline is winning awards today. The customer service is great. You've got new aircraft. You're changing the way things deal. The world deals, moves. The troubled political relations between the Russian Federation, the United States, to some extent Europe, tied to the U.S. elections perhaps last year, perhaps tied to some new elections coming up. Do those pose a major concern to you? What do you see as the big challenges, the disruptive or evolutionary challenges for Aeroflot?
I believe that the industry is not faced with disruptions, unless we talk about external disruptions, so 9/11 or hurricanes or the volcanic ash cloud or something of that kind, but it's faced with evolution, so Darwinian evolution, where there are companies that are more capable of adapting and companies that are less capable of adapting. But everything is an evolutionary approach to success, in my opinion.
Scully, talk about a disruptive airline. WOW certainly meets the bill. You have clearly done so to the light of your customers with low prices, fascinating Six Freedom service over Iceland. You have a technology background, I know, as a founder of a technology company, a founder of an airline. What's it like to be a disruptor? Are there possible future disruptions of concern to you? And also, can you keep those Icelandic volcanoes under control? A real disruptor.
I'm not going to promise the last one, but I still challenge my team and ask ourselves every day, are we a technology company or are we an airline? And I think that if we want to talk about disruptions, I think we are just coming to a point where you will see great innovation taking place that will disrupt the airline industry fundamentally in how we approach customers, how we manage the relationship with the customer, how you stay in contact with the customer, not only pre, during, but also post-travel. And I think the airline is in a great position to become a lot more than precisely just flying between A and B. And this is where I and we see great opportunities. This is where we are. I'm personally spending most of my time today because, again, I think this is something that the airline industry as a whole has not really realized or explored, certainly not properly to date. So that I think, is very interesting. On a more maybe obvious note, with new technology, the new longer-range narrow-body aircrafts, I think that's going to change the historical role of Iceland as a hub. There will be the most obvious routes will not require Iceland anymore. So as a result, what we are doing, we're going further east and west. We just started a nonstop flight to Tel Aviv from Iceland, connecting Israel then through Iceland into North America. We are looking even further east into Asia. So I think Iceland has a great opportunity to become a global hub, if you like, Dubai of the North. Now, clearly, it will require a lot of things to come together, but that's certainly the opportunity we're looking at.
Carlos, Viva Aerobus has emerged very quickly to become a major player, a disruptor, I'd venture, in the U.S.-Mexico market for sure, and elsewhere. Your airline has some very interesting DNA. As I mentioned, some genes from the busing sector, and also some genes from the founders of Ryanair. How do you approach future disruptive challenges? Are you worried that the new language, the wall language coming from Washington this year, NAFTA, immigration, the proposed wall, do they herald a major policy disruption for your plans to expand?
Well, certainly a quick brief on Viva. I mean, we're fastest growing low-cost carrier in Mexico, 16-17% market share, most profitable carrier in Latin America. And the most important single reason what we have achieved this is cost. And that's our single most important DNA in our equation. If we consistently manage to keep our costs down, we can successfully come out from all type of external disruptions. I mean, Mexico is situated between two oceans. We have all sort of hurricanes from the Pacific, from the Atlantic. We even had three consecutive earthquakes in the month of September. So these type of things, might hit demand. But certainly when you have a low cost and you can offer low fares, you can overcome these type of situations. Regarding your other question, certainly we have another hurricane from the north, which is a Hurricane Trump, hitting a lot of political turmoil between the two countries, which have been big partners for many years. And I mean, we simply have a simple approach. If a wall is built, we'll fly them all. I mean, I just need to remember everybody that 90% of U.S. immigration is people that enter with a permit. That after they enter the U.S. soil, the valid permit finish, they stay there, right? So if the price is right, we will continue to get demand, as we are seeing it, very strong demand. Companies growing 30% a year. So that's the most important way how we can keep growing the market.
So Aldi, disruption. Can you give us 2 or 3 minutes max? 2 or 3 minutes about what disruption you're facing, what challenges you face. You are truly an airline that is a huge success story. Most admired airline in Africa, I think it's fair to say. You have survived political turmoil, you have survived natural disasters, economic challenges, and yet you're expanding service today. I tip my hat to you and your success. What do you see as the challenges before Ethiopian today?
Well, disruption, I think all of us here in the airline business must have gotten used to it. It has always been a very dynamic industry. And a lot of disruptions in the past, a lot of disruptions today, and that will continue in the future. It is a very complex and one of the most difficult industry. Of course, we have some technological disruptions on our way, regulatory and economic cycles, and now the neo-nationalism coming in different forms. But I think these are the discontinuities in the industry that have been with us, and it continues. I think for all of us, no matter what kind of disruptions in the industry, the secret that we have all learned is it's all about leadership. Leadership in terms of internally enabling a strong internal capacity which can withstand any kind of turbulence in the industry from any direction, and also strong leadership which can scan the environment and adapt to the changes or prepare for the changes.
Let's talk a minute about business models. We have two low-cost carriers. We have a carrier that I'm not exactly sure, network carrier, transformative carrier. This low-cost, longer-haul model, is it going to succeed? I've heard some bad language coming from one great leader of the low-cost world, Mr. O'Leary, saying that some of his competitors, like Norwegian, might not be around soon. That's troubling to me, because Norwegian's a client that I've advised. Who would like to take a shot? The disruption of a low-cost carriers, is that a disruption that's going to continue, or is there going to be some change that will smooth this out in the future? Maybe, Scully, start with you.
Sure. I would rather than talk about low-cost or low-fare, you know, all airlines in the world have to become and continuously become more efficient. And competition is just such that there is no working around that. And I think all airlines, more or less, will have separate segmentation within the aircraft, addressing also the bare-bone fare structure that was originally driven by the low-cost carriers. So that playing field will become more muddy, if you like. But again, I think the true survivors will be the adopters of technology. So those who understand technology, understand the customers, use big data, they will be able to bring down the fares to a point where literally it can be afforded by anyone, because they will have so many alternative revenue streams coming through that customer knowledge. That's the true disruptor. And that allows us to compete against anyone at any price level, because it's not about just the per seat revenue. So this is where I see, again, the survivors or failures in the next 5 years, if you like.
Juan Carlos.
I totally agree. I mean, in a low-cost business model, I mean, I think short-haul travel has demonstrated how there's a big gap in profitability between successful low-cost carriers and traditional full-service carriers. And I couldn't agree more with Scully Ingwich. Big data and ancillary revenue plays a big role in a profitable low-cost carrier operation. I mean, you cannot be successful just by selling fares. I mean, traditionally, and successful low-cost carriers are the ones that have a big a part of their revenue equation on the ancillary revenue arena, and that's where you can play a lot in the e-commerce funnel on the purchasing experience of your clients, because there's plenty of opportunity you can make more money apart from the a highly elastic fare component, right? In my opinion, not only the technology and the ancillary revenue part is very important for successful long-haul operators, but it's also the business model. I mean, we have seen it in the last 30 years that many full-service carriers have attempted to try and start their own low-cost carrier, and 90% of them have failed, right? Very few have still remaining low-cost carriers, because it's a very different type of thinking business model. The way you set up the airline, the way you run them, the way that management teams think. I mean, in a pure ULCC business model, we're focusing constantly on meeting passenger basic needs. And traditionally, full-service carriers are trying to meet passenger wants, and it's a big difference. So, I mean, it's a way you operate an important part of the DNA.
Giorgio, you have a different business model. You're not, however, one of the immunized core alliance members. In SkyTeam, but not part of what I call the Air France Delta core. Your thoughts?
Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, I repeat my point of view, which is that there is no disruption, there is evolution. And I see so many examples around us, in the sense that when Toyota came into the U.S. with a different approach to manufacturing cars and selling cars, were they a disruptor, or were they providing a more customer-focused, cost-effective, time-effective solution? So the idea that the airline industry is unique in its ability to understand the customers, in its ability to evolve technology, in its ability to be a global industry is, in my opinion, unfounded. There are many other industries that have proven to be capable of living through evolutionary cycles, even more challenging, and we as aviation industry should look at those examples to learn what they've done well and what they've done not so well. Having said that, I think that in all, let me say, key industries, there are a portfolio of products which are targeted to different customer segments. In particular, there are, as in the car industry, customers that will buy a BMW 7 Series, and customers that from the same car manufacturer will buy a BMW 1 Series with no optionals at all. So the problem is understanding the price point, understanding the different expectations of the customer. That's what we try to do as Aeroflot. So we have the premium carrier, Aeroflot, And we have the low-cost carrier, so Pabieda, which I pride to, am proud to believe is one of the 10% of the cases that are successful. Because I agree with Juan Carlos that you have to have a different mindset. In particular, you have to accept that there is internal competition, because internal competition, if driven by an effort to better understand the customer, will then enable different products within the same grouping to be successful.
Victoria Moores with Air Transport World. It seems a lot easier to look forward and project sort of 5 or 10 years in terms of trends and whereabouts things are going. What does the panel think that we're concretely going to see in terms of disruptors, major developments, trends within the industry in the coming 12 months, so in 2018?
Who'd like to take it?
No, I'll, if you allow me, John, I'd like to link my comments to the technology part, in the sense that when we talk about disruption or evolution, the elephant in the room, in my opinion, are the regulators, in the sense that we're talking about, and I totally agree with what was said earlier on about the customer approach to finding more competitive fares. Now, people have forgotten that GDSs were regulated. So in showing or comparing fares, they had to follow certain rules. Online travel agencies or meta searchers do not have to comply with that. And the regulators are fine with that. So what I really see as a challenge, and I go back to your question in terms of technology evolution, is the role and the approach that the regulators will play in considering this access to the market, because basically the Googles of this world control access to the market in a way. So that's really the big challenge. So trying understanding what the regulators will do, if anything, when basically putting at a disadvantage independent and supposedly objective GDSs versus meta search engines. Thank you.
Juan Carlos, Schooley, anything on the disruptive fears about regulators and disruptions, changes in the next 12 months? Victoria's question.
Well, certainly disruption in technology, I believe, is what's moving much faster than OEMs or other type of technology and equipment, right? So if your question is directly on the next 12 months, I don't see a big change on technology for equipment. I mean, it took Boeing and Airbus and the OEMs 15 years to develop a fuel-saving technology of 15% when oil right now is 50% down for the last 3 years, right? So, I mean, they're always late to the party. But in technology, I think that's biggest disruptors. I'm a big fan of Google Flight Search. We were the first test case for them in Latin America. And I have a very similar approach as Colin, which passengers are getting savvy, and they try to compare. And when you have the lowest cost fares on the market you compete, for me, it's free advertising, right? How I see the meta search or the OTAs, right? At the end, if you have a higher price on the OTAs, they will end up buying you direct on your sites, right? So that's how we see it, as free advertising.
Let me just ask one thing. Alan Joyce of Qantas recently challenged Airbus, Boeing, anybody else out there, I guess, to build a longer haul aircraft that can go all the way from, let's say, London to every part of Australia. Are there technology demands you have of aircraft producers that you'd like to see met? That would be transformative for you? Is there something the airline manufacturers should do that would make a big difference in your business in the next 5-10 years? I can't do it overnight. I know that.
Well, we would love to see a fully electric plane, right? To eliminate, which is going to be highly difficult, but I mean, something very similar to what we're seeing on the automobile industry, I mean, which is going to be a true disruptor and will kill the Detroit companies, right? I mean, it's far from that. There are very few attempts, but I mean, the example I just put, I mean, it took them like 10 years to develop the Pratt & Whitney and the CFM technology just to save 15% fuel burn, right? While right now fuel is coming down, right? So Hopefully we can get an electric plane in the next decade or something truly disruptive that will bring costs down significantly. That will be a great benefit for consumers.
Either of you, comments on a new plane you'd like to have?
Well, we certainly would love to see the electric plane. It's something that I've been talking to them quite a lot about, and there's no doubt it will happen eventually. Unfortunately, I think it's going to take more than a decade based on their past performance, and I say that with all the love for my friends at Airbus. But one thing that I actually think can be innovated relatively easily, if we put our minds to it, is how to reconfigure the cabin more or less or almost in real time. So still meet all the regulatory safety issues, etc. But I think it would be fantastic, depending on the load, that you could, again, upsell part of the cabin in a way that you see that you have 10 free seats, and then that can be arranged in such a way that it gives you even more flexibility, more room. So that's something that I find quite interesting, and I think it's doable.
I think Air New Zealand has done a little bit of stuff on that front in some ways. Giorgio.
Yeah, I think that Alan Joyce devised a genial publicity stunt. So it for free. So that was going back to what was said. I mean, that was free advertising. What I think you heard from all of us is that cost control is the crucial word. And there's no way that you can have effective cost control if you have hyper-segmented fleet types. So one airplane to fly one route, another airplane to fly a different route, and so on. So customers are telling us, and we see it in the U.S., John, that for them, comfort on board, leg room, customer service are less important than price. And you can only deliver price if you have standardized fleet types. So the idea of being able to play with cabin configuration is truly the evolutionary thought, not aircraft that can fly 17 hours nonstop.
Thank you. I've got a great question from the audience. How do you see the role of virtual interlining self-connecting to drive passenger traffic and revenues? Particular question for low-cost carriers, people self-connecting. Any comments on that? That's something that's developing as we speak.
That's the approach we're taking, in which since we don't have co-chairing with any other airlines, etc., and passengers with Viva are going to be able to do some of sectors. I mean, which they buy two single sectors, we charge a fee, and passengers self-connect on a given airport, right? So it's, you save some airport costs, and passengers can add two sectors and self-connect, right? So we're taking that approach.
Can you take the fear out of self-connecting? I know it's a little bit dangerous. If I fly on, I came over on American Airlines from Philadelphia. They're going to take care of me, I think, I hope. If I self-connect from Southwest to American Airlines, I'm a little more worried. Are you trying to address that?
No. I mean, we're just focusing on self-connections within the same airline, right? But we're not partnering or working with another airline. So it's just between the same flights.
Okay. Any other comments on self-connecting from the panel? Scully.
Yeah, well, I think it's an extremely important issue. And I think the airports can do a lot in this area as well. We see Gatwick Connect as an example in London. That's working very well. Unfortunately, the cost or the penalties for any disruption in the process is currently, I think, penalizing the airlines to do something in this area.
You mean the European delayed flight?
Yes. That makes it hard to do it in a sort of informal manner that I would ideally want to do with other LCCs.
Do you see potential for changing that? I mean, the trend, it seems to me, in the last 10 years has been toward more, I'll call it consumer protection, more protectionism, more paternalism towards consumers. You think you can turn that around in Europe?
I wouldn't bet on it, but no, clearly there's opportunities to do better. And I think it's a combination of the regulatory environment, the airports, and the airlines, for sure.
Thank you. Victoria Moores again from Air Transport World. My question is for Tewolde. Part of the success of Ethiopia's strategy has been to create other hubs outside of Addis Ababa. So you've had the very successful partnership with ASKY, for example. I was wondering how that strategy is developing in terms of new partnerships that you might be creating and new hubs, because we've heard some talk about maybe Nigeria, maybe Mozambique. Can you share some information on that, please?
Yeah, we are a little bit delayed in forming those hubs. The West African hub in with ASKY in Lomé has been successful and it is operating well. Another plan to form the same similar hub in Southern Africa was delayed, but I think now with the Zambian government joint venture, we are about on the final stage. And then we have, as you may know, we have a small airline called Malawian in Lilongwe that was supposed to form a Southern African hub, but the market is not as big as we thought, and it could not grow. That's why we have the joint venture in Zambia. And we are also working with Congo Airways in Kinshasa, the DRC, which is a very large country and a very rich country, but with political turmoil and instability. So Nigeria is a big market, but the regulatory system is kind of difficult. We have also special difficulty there because the West African hub that we have formed in Togo, Lomé, is so close to the Nigerian market. So we are working with the government of Nigeria to form some kind of an airline there which can cooperate with ASKY. Yeah, Mozambique is also now open for us, and we have been selected as an airline to do domestic business and also international. So both Malawi and Ethiopian Airlines, and we have started negotiation with the Mozambican government. But that is going to be a locally registered airline in Mozambique. Thank you. Thank you.
Got a question over here.
Thanks, John. Max Kingsley-Jones from Flight Global. It's a question actually for all the panel, perhaps particularly Giorgio and Scully. I wonder if you subscribe to the view that there are too many airlines in the world, particularly maybe in Europe, and do you see consolidation playing out there the way one or two people, perhaps Mr. O'Leary, recently projected that we're going to see some changes, perhaps driven by Brexit or perhaps driven by just M&A in the sector between low cost and full service?
Yes, I do think there's going to be continuous challenges and turbulence for many of the legacy carriers, many of the carriers that are not as efficient and that do not adopt the technologies. I'm not necessarily sure that the best solution is always to do a takeover or a merger. You know, unlike math, two minuses doesn't make one positive in many of these cases. And I think the industry is sometimes better off just to let go and move on. But my guess is that there will be fewer bigger players 5 years from now, yes.
Anyone else on the panel?
Thanks for the question, Max. Well, I'm a bit conflicted considering my past, but I'll try and answer nevertheless. Consolidation is a trend that is an irreversible trend. I mean, it's happening all over, and Tewolde just explained how he's addressing potential consolidation in Africa. So there are many ways for that to happen, either a successful carrier expanding and identifying opportunities, either a classical M&A operation, or you just wait for the competitor basically to disappear, which seems to be the case in Germany lately. But the trend is certainly irreversible, and the driving force will be, again, in my opinion, not disruption, but successful evolution in terms of focus on customer understanding and cost efficiency.
Thank you. I'm going to take the mic to a question in the back, but in the meantime, we have a good question here on Minty. How do you respond to over-tourism in your planning? And we had that wonderful presentation to kick us off about the overcrowding of many destinations, the extraordinary rush into places, passengers not, or tourists not getting the experience they're expecting of open, beautiful beaches, but of incredible crowds. Is this something you as airlines see as a part of your mission to deal with, or frankly, is that somebody else's problem to solve?
Certainly not the case in Mexico. I mean, having so many beaches, I mean, what we have seen is that some tourist destinations move faster than others. So what we try to do is just keep pace with hotel development in certain regions. For example, Riviera Maya and Cancun in Mexico is outpacing the growth any other beach destination. But, I mean, that simply creates just competition for all the other tourist destinations to speed up their development so they can be more competitive and more attractive, right? So, I mean, airlines, we're always trying to put seats where demand is, and that's the way we play it.
I think for us airlines in Africa, this is not a problem because the tourist destinations are lacking tourists, rather. So overcrowding is not a problem because it's a very large continent with so many attractions, so many beautiful destinations looking for tourists, and also a lot of historical and ancient civilization attraction places. So I think the tour operator community, the tour operators community need to diversify their destinations in terms of offering the tourists new destinations and new avenues, because Africa is the least visited continent in the world, with around 53 million tourists visiting the continent, and some part of it is within the continent. So I think the problem in Africa is the reverse.
I'll try and offer a different perspective, because yes, I'm fine with you know, putting the airlines on the judging panel, but I also believe that thanks to competitive and ever easier access to air transportation, lots of people have had the opportunity to visit places that they never had a chance to visit before. So before over tourism, there is tourism, which is important, as I was mentioning earlier on, for Russia. So a safe, reliable, and competitive aviation industry has allowed people from the center of Russia to go and have their week in the sun. And that's important. That's quality of life. So yes, we need to be more careful. But I believe that in this sense, the market is somewhat self-regulating, because overcrowded places tend to overcharge and underserve. That in itself drives a decrease in tourism, and that decrease in tourism will be met by decreased number of flights. So I do believe that the system has a self-regulating opportunity in itself.
Skúli, anything? Iceland has created itself as a true destination place, and it's been a remarkable success. Too many tourists in Iceland?
I still think that we can do a lot more, and it's like most things, just a question of organizing yourself properly. I often use the example of Falling Waters, the Frank Lloyd Wright House, just out of Chicago. They get 1 million visitors a year in that single house. And it's not overcrowded, it's extremely well organized. You have to book online, you get your designated slot, you have to book in advance, you cannot just show up. You park about 800 meters away from the house, and you walk, and you're informed that you need to be able to do that in order to see the house. So again, very informative website, well organized, well planned. So Iceland as a whole, we currently have about 2.5 million visitors. I think, again, we can easily handle that and then some.
I saw a good friend from Pittsburgh Airport sort of expressing dismay that Falling Water, which is a wonderful site to visit, I'd like to put in a big plug for it, it's a little closer to Pittsburgh than Chicago. So fly to Pittsburgh. Is that that's the competitive response here. And I also think, having been a visitor to Addis Ababa on three occasions in my life, yes, if you think the crowds are too big in Venice, go to this incredible city of Addis Ababa. Wonderful people, wonderful sights. I think there's an opportunity for cities and destinations to compete. We're not as crowded as you are, X, Y, and Z. There's an opportunity there. So maybe the market can regulate it. I'm not sure you're going to find self-regulation working, but I'm just a moderator. We have a question here.
Thank you. My name is Samson Mengistu, Los Angeles Airport. With Viva Airbus poised to start service to LAX later this year, our airport may be the only airport in the world that has flight for all your four airlines. The quick question is that, how much do you think your passengers are willing to sacrifice legroom and service in favor of pricing, and how much are you willing to push that?
Who wants the first shot?
I think that question is two approaches on short-haul travel and long-haul travel. In short-haul travel, flights less than 3.5 hours, price is 80% decision factor for the consumers, right? So, I mean, we operate A320s with 186 seats, right? Maximum seat configuration available yet. When the price is right, consumers will pay much less for the flight to enjoy and spend the dollars in Los Angeles, right? Because at the end, we're just a transportation, right? And we want to make money in many other things consumer want to spend during their journey, and that's where the margins are.
Others want to comment on that? To Aldi.
I think it's the same for short haul and long haul. They're different. On the long haul, I think there is the minimum that we have in the industry. It cannot go, smaller than that. In terms of pricing, although legroom has a big impact on the pricing, but I think on the long haul, it looks like that the airline seats are commoditized, so they're commodities, meaning the passenger assumes that they will get the same level of seat comfort whether they fly with airline A or B or C. So what's driving the price lower or higher is the level of intensity in the competition. So as long as excess capacity prevails in the industry, prices will continue to come down. And of course, passengers or customers are looking for more for less. So we don't see a direct correlation on seat comfort and price. Of course, all other factors remaining constant, which they don't in real life, people will pay more price, better price for better legroom. But I think the other factors are now dominating in the determination of the price. And that is determined in the market. And there is huge overcapacity, excess capacity in the industry. And I think that is the dominant factor for all the illness in the industry. Thank you.
Let me introduce a question that was on Minty here. Maybe more for Schooley, for Juan Carlos. Could the cost-cutting mindset on employee salaries that are critical in many ways to the ultra-low-cost carrier success, could that mean that ultra-low-cost model is, in the longer term, no longer viable? And they mentioned the problems that Ryanair is experiencing right now with pilots, having enough pilots, the real bottleneck in pilots, and the therefore increased pilot salaries that people are having to pay. Do you see the labor costs rising at low cost to reach a level that will make that low-cost model not so successful in the future? And Carlos?
I mean, our view for a successful low-cost car is to be heavily outsourced. I mean, Ryanair is an example. But if you try to take away some non-key functions of your business in order to avoid scaling costs overnight and just pass those costs to third-party vendors like ground handling companies, etc. In the case of pilots and flight attendants, which are unfortunately currently costs that we need to employ, the approach we have taken at Viva is you need to make them partners in the way in which try to flex their compensations, in which 50% is fixed, 15% is fully variable, so you can flex the profitability of your business when they with the compensation of your staff, right? So in summer, everybody makes a lot of money, but in February, when it's a low season in Mexico, we align interests between management, shareholders, and employees. So, but if you communicate and you articulate this with your staff and they know they work for a low-cost carrier, we have not hired a single pilot or flight attendant coming from a full-service carrier out of Mexico. So, I mean, you have people very proud and very committed with the brand and with the company. The problem sometimes is when you start working with unions and other different mindsets of traditional full-service carrier industries in which they try to start to bring on some traditional perks and benefits that will kill your business.
Schooley, how do you keep labor costs from rising to a level where you're not as competitive as you'd like to be?
I think the key is to be open with your employees about the realities around you. So at any given time, this is a highly competitive industry. As long as you communicate openly with them, it becomes quite obvious. So if you drive up your costs too high or at any level and you don't become competitive anymore, there are so many examples that you can point to where it's not about then reducing the salaries, you will lose your job. You know, the airline will not survive, it will not succeed. So again, to me, it's all about sharing and being open with your employees about your strategy, your business model, your how things are going, and you should be okay.
How would a change in U.S. open skies policy in the direction of being a more restrictive policy, and there's been some talk lately about that, how would that impact your route decisions to the U.S. market, specifically non-gateway markets? Do you see, if that were to happen, if you were to see in the Trump administration a scaling back, you think that could affect your planning, or do you just think that's not going to happen? Any thoughts on this question?
Yes, we are concerned over, I would say, the broader, bigger political environment that we are faced with today on multiple levels. Brexit, we had the UK was our biggest market. With the pound weakening, we saw an immediate impact. Now, obviously, London became cheaper, or England became more cheaper, so it worked also in the other way. But yeah, clearly, I think the political environment, the realities that we live with today is of concern. I think it should be a concern of all of us.
Giorgio, no open skies, Russian Federation, United States, real political tensions. Does it concern you? You think the Trump administration might ban Aeroflot from flying to the United States? Is that a big concern?
Well, if you allow me, John, I will recuse myself from commenting on the Trump administration.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't blame you.
But in general, I would say that once the market is being open, it's very difficult to close it again. So in principle, I don't see that happening. I mean, it's not the way that the industry evolves. And even if there would be, efforts to restrict access to an open market, I think that operators would find a way to still serve that market. And we've seen it in Europe with the approach to liberalization and the extension of liberalization to different countries and the way it was interpreted in relations to connections between Europe and North Africa, Europe and South America, and so on. So in principle, I don't see that happening.
Juan Carlos Tewaldi, anything on this you'd like to say? Open skies policy in the U.S.? Open skies with Mexico just happened with the end of the administration of President Obama.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that's a good news. After 60 years, we had finally the bilaterals destroyed and open. Now every carrier can compete on every route, so that's good news for low-cost carriers. We were a little bit concerned, to be honest, at the beginning of the year and early last year after the election, particularly because there was much more noise than what actually happened. But I mean, we see very strong states in the U.S. For example, California, particularly LA or New York, where there's a big tourism between Mexico and the U.S. In which, I mean, they are welcoming a relationship with Mexico more stronger than ever, right? So I mean, that's the reason why we're flying these places, because I mean, they're having different approaches and putting incentives and putting all sort of attractions for airlines to speed up their travel. So, I mean, between these regions, I wouldn't see a big impact, but eventually, after the NAFTA renegotiation at the end of the year, let's see what happens with commerce and between the two countries.
Tewaldi, the United States and Ethiopia have had open skies for over 10 years. I often, when I speak to university students, law schools, aviation universities, mention Ethiopia as an example of what open skies policy is all about, because only Ethiopian flies the routes that are available there. No U.S. airline has thus far flown scheduled passenger service to Ethiopia. But I think it's a success because of that. But does the new trend, sort of America first, does that worry you, or do you not see a problem?
I don't think it's a problem for us because as you said, we have had this open skies agreement for more than 10 years, and a few other countries in Africa have also open skies agreement. And the result, when you see it today, the connectivity between the United States and Africa is still very low. The demand is not well served, so there is room from either party. Either from African side or from the U.S. side to increase capacity. There is under capacity. So because of that, we don't think that there will be a major change in the policy. And I think even in the rest of the world, we see that there is more. The concern from the U.S. side seems to be more of the type of competition. And even competition as perceived or as claimed there to be the reason of concern. So I don't think the U.S. is intending to change open skies policy, but the type of competition, the carriers who are affected by the open skies policy are concerned on the type of competition, the level of competition, and associated issues.
Thank you. I saw a question in the back.
Thank you. My name is Dominik Sapinski. I'm a journalist and a consultant from Poland. I've got a question to all of the panelists, but specifically, I think, to Mr. Mogensen and Mr. Gebremarian. You've mentioned before the changes in technology when it comes to airframes, airplanes, and new capabilities they offer. So I was wondering how much of an impact will that have on your networks given the specificities of Iceland and Addis Ababa airports in the next few years, given where you can fly, how you can fly, how many passengers you can carry on some new routes that you cannot offer right now.
Scully.
So I think in the near term, we are already seeing the market being flooded with direct flights between the most obvious destinations in Europe and on the East Coast in the U.S. As a result, ultimately, they will bypass Iceland. So that clearly poses a threat to our current business model, if you like. So, but at the same time, those very same aircrafts, again, gives us an opportunity to reach. So we're using the 321neo to fly directly between Reykjavik and Tel Aviv. So it's a 7.5-hour flight. on a 220-seat narrow-body aircraft, you know, with great performance, which is very interesting. Something that we might not necessarily want it to have done with a 330 or a bigger aircraft being more challenging to fill. So, you know, at one end, it creates threats as more aircrafts enter the market. But also, very importantly, these smaller aircrafts with longer range gives you the opportunity to go into smaller or medium-sized cities that the wide bodies would not necessarily be able to support. So both great opportunities and threats at the same time.
I think we have time for about one more good question. Oh, two questions. I see two hands, so we're going to do two questions.
Yes, Hamish Rapp from Geneva Airport. My question, if we were now in 2009, for example, and had to discuss disruptions, certainly the fuel cost would have been one of this issue, and we didn't have anything about that. We know that new forms of kerosene, biokerosene or biofuel are in the pipeline, I would say. What is your view about that, and how, as airlines, are you preparing for that?
There have been several tests done, at least in my region, but I mean and mainly that, in my opinion, that has been done for PR stunts, because the cost of biofuels right now is significantly high versus the current fuel, right? So I mean there had not been so far a biofuel massively being produced that can reduce the price of current fuel. Plus, having said that, fuel has come down 50% in the last 3 years, right? I mean, right now we're talking about a jet fuel gallon at $147, and 3 years it was a tree. Actually, the OEMs and the new engine technology, all those business cases were done with fuel at $100 per barrel of oil right now. So, I mean, many of the new engine technology being sold today has a big challenge right now with fuel so low.
Hello, my name is Jürgen Hild. I'm in the airline industry. And referring to the topic of this discussion, disruptions, I have a question to WOW Air. As a disruptor, if I may so, in 2012, WOW Air entered the market in the nice niche Iceland Air was in. My question is, WOW Air calls itself an ultra-low-cost carrier. But you buy the aircraft with the same lessors, you buy the same fuel, you operate to high-cost airports like Frankfurt, you pay the same landing charges, you produce in a high-cost or high-wage country. What is ultra-low-cost with WOW Air? Or if I may provoke, is ultra-low-cost fashionable?
I'm not sure I want to be labeled as ultra-low-cost. I don't necessarily think that's the right way to describe WOW. Our objective, however, very importantly, and this is something we copy from Michael Leary, you know, he says, we wake up every morning trying to bring down our fares. You know, every day we work hard in lowering the airfares towards our customers in every way possible. Obviously, a big part of that is then also to be cost conscious. But we are adding now a big seat, as an example. So there are many ways where we divert from what you would traditionally call even a low-cost carrier. Why? And it was an earlier question, because we see that we can get a premium for the bigger seat on especially the longer routes. So again, it all becomes maximizing the revenue opportunities for the total aircraft. And if we can get more from, we don't have a business class, we don't have extra services, it is precisely that. It's a bigger seat, and we see that's exactly what customers are willing to pay for. So I'm trying hard to avoid. I like the idea that we have, in a way, claimed the long-haul, low-cost space. It's helped us in our marketing, in our brand awareness, and everything else. But in reality, I don't necessarily like that, partially because of your question, to sort of imply that we're doing something strange or that doesn't make sense.